Now playing Open Floor.
This is Open Floor.
Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix back at it.
An NBA podcast with Sports Illustrated senior writer.
I think it's time that the world get to know
my guy Chris Mannix.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
And now it begins.
Now it begins.
Bang! This is the Open Floor NBA podcast. We'll talk about the league and everything that is going on in it. It has been a wild week in the association. The league's two-day draft is now in the books. And while that draft was going on, we had a flurry of activity around the NBA. Feel, though, bigger than the Brooklyn Nets moving Mikal Bridges across the bridge, for lack of a better word, to New York to play with the New York Knicks. The Nova Knicks now in full effect for next season. This was potentially a landscape-changing deal in the Eastern Conference because now the New York Knicks are loaded up with defensive wings. Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby, Josh Hart, which you kind of need to play against the Boston Celtics. At the same time, the Nets did another deal with the Houston Rockets that got a lot of their draft capital back and sent a lot of Phoenix's draft capital to Houston as the Rockets eye a big deal of their own. We've also got a big free agency decision by Paul George coming up in the next couple of days. Ben Golliver does a tremendous job covering the league for the Washington Post. He joins me to talk about all the activity around the league over the last couple of days. I love this draft. I thought it was a lot of fun because there was an unpredictability to it, starting with the number one overall pick. You had Zach Edey going higher than people thought. You had Kyle Filipowski going a little bit lower than people thought. And then you had Bronny James getting drafted at the back half of the second round. I talked to Kevin about all the activity on draft night and who he thought did well and maybe who he thought didn't do so well in this NBA draft. So stick around. Great conversation with Ben Golliver and Kevin Sweeney coming up next here on the show. All right, Ben Golliver, you are in New York, fresh off attending day two of the NBA draft, the first time that the NBA stretched the draft over 2 days. Your impressions on a two-day NBA draft?
Well, first of all, it's nice to be on opposite coasts. I feel like I'm in your spot here on the East Coast and you're my spot out there out West. It's a little bit backwards. I'm wrapping my minds around it, but that fits the theme because everything was different this year at the NBA draft, right? Day one, it felt like there was just a little bit more time, a little bit more room to breathe. We weren't rushing through like 20 second round picks late into the night at Barclays Center. It really did feel like a more, focused and digestible first round show. So I thought that was a win. Day two was really strange. You know, they rather than doing it at Barclays Center, they didn't have a crowd. They didn't have any fans. They did invite a lot of the prospects, but only about 10 guys showed up. So they had them in this little makeshift green room in kind of this industrial setting above an ESPN television studio where they conducted the draft. So it was very surreal, you know, Spartan, you know, I felt like I was, walking through like an industrial district or something like that. People were joking. This is where the mafia would like, you know, drop some bodies off if they didn't want them to be found. So very unusual way for, NBA players to get their first taste of the professional life. But certainly I think all the focus today was really on Bronny. Is anybody going to take him before the Lakers? Is there any intrigue? And then he finally obviously goes number 55 to Los Angeles. We're set up to have the first father-son combination. And that felt like the big headline from day two.
It did feel, watching on TV, very pandemic-y. With the way it was set up and, you know, the way like Mark Tatum was like in a storage closet, you know, giving away or revealing draft picks. Just felt kind of weird in that way. But look, it's first time they did it. Maybe they'll live and learn. They'll do it maybe in a smaller venue with a public setting next year. It certainly is a living, breathing thing that they'll adjust from time to time. Look, they had some drama in the draft. I mean, it begins with, you know, Kyle Filipowski, getting drafted by Utah and then the social media lid popping off with all the stuff that is going on in Kyle's life with his girlfriend, who apparently is a little bit older, and his family members don't like the girlfriend and all sorts of stuff that I'm sure is going to get talked about a lot in the days and weeks ahead. And then it ends, as you mentioned, with Bronny James. And there are some people out there, Ben, that are just outraged by the fact that Bronny was drafted at 55. Number one, more than anything, I think it's pretty damn cool, right? Like, you've got, you know, arguably the greatest player of all time that now gets a chance to play with his son, forming the first father-son combination to play in the league together, to play on the same team together. I mean, that's remarkable. Like, that really is. And it's going to be very cool next year when we see that Bron to Bronny alley-oop or Bronny to Bron alley-oop at some point during the season. Also, like, I want the people that are criticizing the Lakers for doing this to tell me which 55th pick in the last, like, two decades has panned out. I went back and looked on Basketball Reference, Ben. Kyle Guy was drafted 55th. There's a couple of European guys drafted 55th. Like, nobody pans out at 55. That is the ultimate, you know, swing. And look, if we're being objective, and you're out in L.A. mostly, and I'm out in L.A. now, I went to a lot of those USC games. Like, it's not like Bronny doesn't have upside to him, right? Like, there is some level of talent within him that maybe you didn't get a chance to see because the guy had a friggin' heart attack last summer and had to be eased back into the basketball mix. Yeah, he's got to become a playmaker. He's got to become a better shooter, but there is a defender in him. And I think there is a natural athleticism and skill set that could, putting air quotes on that, could turn him into an NBA player. So not only do I not care about the Lakers blowing the 55th pick on Bronny James, you know, if it's about making LeBron happy, I also think there have been far lower ceilinged guys that were taken at 55 over the last 10 years.
Well, look, if they had used their first round pick, number 17, and rather than get Dalton Knecht, this kid who's a SEC player of the year, shoots the lights out, it's going to be a perfect fit for JJ Redick, and is 23. So he's ready to play now, which is exactly what the Lakers need with LeBron about to turn 40. Then I would understand the outrage a little bit because it feels like you're putting LeBron's interest or the James family interest before the Lakers' interest, right? But I think you've made a very compelling point. Everything is pretty much aligned here with that 55th pick. You could take complete flyers. Remember when that guy who was like 28 years old got illegally drafted by David Cotton of the Minnesota Timberwolves? People didn't even know his
about
name,
that.
Right? So it's like, yeah, sometimes you get guys you're not even allowed to draft in that spot. So at least Bronny is legally draft eligible. The only other 2 points I would make, one to echo yours, it's just amazing that he's healthy and he was able to get back this quickly, right? Like, there was no guarantee he was going to get medical clearance last summer. That's a process you have to go through. The doctors had to check him out. There was no guarantee he was going to be able to get back on the court during the season and play enough to even be in the mix, to go to the combine, to feel like he was going to be able to be a potential draft pick. And there was no guarantee in these situations you're going to get medical clearance from NBA doctors, right? Like, we've seen that in the past, guys who had to be honorary draft picks because the NBA doctors were like, look, you know, this is a tough situation. So you add all those things up, it's a feel-good story. Put aside father-son, it's just great that Bronny is in a position where he could pursue his basketball career. And having first seen him as a freshman at Sierra Canyon, when I thought, wow, this guy could really be a player, look, the growth spurt just never hit, you know? And so he was kind of basically the same guy for the 4 years at high school. Obviously, he really refined his skills, but kind of body-wise, he didn't change all that much. So it's very cool for him to get to this spot. I think the other important piece of context, though, last point, the Lakers pride themselves on being a family organization, right? Jeannie Buss inherits the team from her father. She took over from her brother. She talks about Magic Johnson like he's a brother. We know how the Lakers treat Kobe Bryant, you know, and look at how they're honoring both him and Gianna, his daughter, with the statue, right? This is a part of what the Lakers do. So does it surprise me that the Lakers really want to re-sign LeBron and are willing to do whatever it takes, including bringing part of his family into their family? It shouldn't surprise anyone, and it definitely doesn't surprise me. And if you want to take it even further than that, look at Linda Rambis, Kurt Rambis, you know, they're like advisors to Jeannie. I mean, it is one big family here in Los Angeles, even though the Lakers are this massive international brand, they kind of run it like a mom and pop shop. And I think if any team was going to do this, to take this kind of step towards history, I feel like it's naturally that it would be the Lakers.
I was with you right up until Kurt and Linda Rambis, because they have no business being
I'm not saying this is how it should be. I'm just saying this is how it is, Chris. You know what I mean?
Look, it's the way it goes. I mean, if we're going to be outraged about Bronny getting drafted, can we all just remember that Thanasis Antetokounmpo has been on the Bucks bench for like 6 years now, right? He has been earning a salary on the Bucks bench for a long time, and that's because Giannis is on the team. So it's just the way it goes. I have no issue whatsoever, no outrage whatsoever with all this. In fact, I think it's going to be pretty cool next year. All right, so I want to talk NBA stuff with you because in addition to the draft, it has been an active week in the NBA, none more so than in New York with the Knicks, who finally took the big, big swing. They took a medium-sized swing at midseason, acquiring OG Anunoby from the Raptors. And now this summer, they take the full swing, dealing 5 first-round draft picks, including 4 of their own, some pick swaps, to the Brooklyn Nets in exchange for Mikal Bridges. So the Nova Knicks are in full swing now. 4 members of the Villanova basketball team are now teammates once again in New York. My question for you, Ben, is how much better did the Knicks get? I know it's a phenomenal story, and I believe Mikal Bridges is a phenomenal player. But now that we see what their rotation is going to look like with Anunoby, with Brunson, with Bridges, of course, Mitchell Robinson coming back, Julius Randle coming back, Josh Hart, probably coming off the bench, I guess, right now, but that is a conversation for another day. Like, how much better did they get? Where do you slot them right now amongst Eastern Conference contenders?
Well, I think the big narrative coming out is they're trying to challenge Boston, right? I'd still have Boston above them because of the top-end talent on Boston's roster and because of the cohesiveness. I mean, you can talk about the Nova Knicks all you want, but these Celtic stars played a lot of minutes together in the regular season and the playoffs, and they're going to come back so confident. I actually think Jason Tatum had a so-so finals, but I think he looked nervous a lot. He's not going to be nervous next year. He's going to be over that because he got over the hump. He's been carrying that Larry O'Brien trophy around all summer long. So I have Boston at 1, but I think you can make a strong case for New York at 2. And I do think they got better. They were already really good. And I think what Mikal Bridges does is he plugs into a role that fits him. We learned in that Brooklyn era, he can't do more. He cannot be an alpha. And you don't even really want him to be the number 2. You want him to be that ultra reliable, night in, night out, 3-and-D versatile wing, guy who's going to be an all defensive level player, knock down shots, be a little bit of a secondary creator, but not a lot more than that. And I think when you look at the Knicks, I mean, this is probably their best roster in 25 years, which maybe that's saying something. Maybe it's not saying all that much, but they're in a nice spot depth-wise. My biggest question, though, I'd be very curious to hear what you say. Where does Randle fit into all this? Does Randle wind up being the center where they go smaller? Because they're going to, you know Tibbs. He's going to play Bridges and OG Anunoby. And maybe he doesn't start Hart, but he's going to play Hart a lot of minutes, right? So he's going to be going with those heavy wing lineups a lot. And of course, Brunson's never coming off the court because he's one of the best players in the league. So Randle, I mean, does his minutes and his role get reduced? Does he wind up getting traded because, you know, they look so good without him during the playoffs? I mean, obviously they needed him at times during the postseason, but they were rolling along there right through Philadelphia in the first round. I'm just curious, how do you think that's going to shake out? Because I've seen a lot of talk about, oh, this means they probably don't get to keep Hartenstein. Oh, maybe Mitchell Robinson is going to be a casualty of this entire trade scenario. But what about Randle? Is he just still part of the core or what?
It's a good question. And look, when one of the reasons I think Randle had been kept around in New York is because if they were going to make a big trade for an Embiid, a Giannis, somebody of that caliber, they were going to need that contract, right? Like Julius Randle's contract would be a big part of a deal. They didn't need to use it to go and make the Mikal Bridges deal. So now you have him here on the roster. And I'm not so sure how he fits with this group of guys. I mean, look, they didn't advance past the second round in the postseason, but you can make an argument they were a better team without Randle as part of the rotation in the second half of the season. Like Brunson really took off. Like he became a top 5 MVP with Randle out of the lineup. His game went to another level when he wasn't kind of sharing the load with Randle. Maybe that's not a recipe for winning a championship, but look, Randle's playoff numbers have not been good over the years. And now you're trying to plug him in as the power forward alongside Bridges and Anunoby and Brunson. I don't know. I guess I don't really have a good answer for how Randle ultimately fits in. I do think, like, if Hartenstein winds up walking, right, and there's a pretty good chance that happens because he's going to be a sought-after guy this summer, that hurts them a lot. Like, he was really good for them, especially offensive glass last year. And look, Robinson, I think, if he's healthy, makes up for it, but he's not healthy all the time. Like, he gets hurt. So I think that's an area where they could take a step back. And look, I say this as a firm believer the Knicks did the right thing. I mean, when you have an opportunity to take a swing for a guy that every team in the NBA wanted a piece of, you go and do it. Like, I agree with the philosophy and the pushing all their chips in right now. But they've got a starting lineup, Ben. Like, four All-Star appearances between them, like amongst the five guys. And Randle's got like three of them. So, I still think there is a gap between the Knicks and the Celtics going into next year. They're obviously more equipped to defend the Celtics because now you have Anunoby, you've got Bridges, you've got Hart. You have got guys that have the size and skill set to give Tatum and Brown a lot of trouble. But as you know, the Celtics are a lot more than just Tatum and Brown. Porzingis, when he's healthy, is a weapon. Jrue Holiday is a weapon. Derek White is a weapon. Like, there, I still think there's a decent size gap between the Knicks and Celtics going into next season.
No question, but there was a bigger than a decent size gap between the Celtics and the rest of the East this year, right? By the time we got to the playoffs, I mean, they rolled through the Eastern Conference. It was a joke, man. I mean, I know everybody wanted to talk up. Andrew Nembhard got so excited about that 48 hours where it looks somewhat competitive in the Eastern Conference. Give me a break. Those guys were cakewalking through the whole thing, right? So we needed another challenger. What I liked about this Knicks trade, I mean, look, they did pay a lot, and they shouldn't get off the hook for paying a lot, right? I mean, they really have to make this work here because they have been waiting and waiting and flirting with these other stars, not really doing any deals. This is their move, so it has to work, right? But what I love about it is the timing, right? You have Milwaukee coming back to Earth. You have Philadelphia coming back to Earth. You have Miami coming back to Earth. You have, in my opinion, Indiana not looking ready for primetime. New York was the number two seed this year, right? I'm glad they're acting like it. It didn't always feel like they were the number two seed during the playoffs because they had so many injury issues, because they were going against a team in Philly that had the bigger star, you know, the biggest name on the court in Joel Embiid. But they're conducting themselves like a number two seed that's trying to get over the hump. Will they need some help to dethrone Boston? Will there need to be an injury? Will something have to go wrong for the Celtics? Possibly. But we are in this era where it's very difficult to repeat. There's a lot of parity. You just want to be in the mix. And when you're close, you got to take a shot. And I just love the timing from New York being willing to take that shot.
So the Nets are obviously going into a full rebuild. And part of that rebuild was they went out and made a deal with Houston that effectively got their draft capital back. They made a deal with the Rockets that sent the Rockets the Phoenix Suns capital that they had acquired in the Kevin Durant deal. And the Rockets sent back some of the Nets capital that they had made the trade with for the James Harden deal. So the Houston Rockets.
It reminds me of being in high school. You know, bully steals
so
your.
Weird.
It reminds me of being in high school. Bully steals your lunch money. You ask for some French fries. You know, it's like, could I, you
I know.
Know.
Well, the Rockets, I get what the Rockets are doing, right? They went from shorting the Brooklyn Nets to shorting the Phoenix Suns, right? Like they're betting on the failures of the Suns after spending the last couple of years betting on the failure of the Nets. And the Nets, of course, like they know they're going to be really bad, so it's good to be really bad and have your picks. They learned that 10 years ago when they were really bad and didn't have their picks, and those two guys that they could have drafted are now winning a championship in Boston. So now you've got the Houston Rockets out there with all this Phoenix Suns draft capital, with a team that is improving, some really good young pieces on that roster. What do you make of what the Rockets are doing right now? I mean, there's some reporting that they want a piece of Kevin Durant. You know, Matt Ishbia came out and said Kevin Durant's not for sale right now. You know, Paul George is certainly out there. What do you make of kind of the Rockets' position as they head into free agency?
Well, I don't really love any of their young guys, to be honest. I think my favorite one of their prospects is Jabari Smith Jr., but I got to admit, I mean, they completely overperformed my expectations last year, especially on the defensive end. And I still don't know if all of their young pieces really make each other better, right? Like, it felt like Jalen Green played better when Sengun wasn't going. Sengun felt like he had more success when Jalen Green was struggling earlier in the season. So is this a cohesive group? I'm not completely convinced. But the bet they made with the Nets picks was a really interesting one. It sounded to me like their logic was, we don't want to get more picks now because we don't have room to play young players because we already have enough young players. That's actually a really smart conclusion to reach because they do already have too many young players. Like, if you're Amen Thompson, you're probably looking over at Asar thinking like he's probably going to get a lot more minutes, a lot more touches, a lot more chances to make mistakes in Detroit than Amen's going to be getting in Houston, right? It's an obvious comparison because they're twins, right? And I think Amen came in, everybody thought he was going to be the better pro, but it's just hard to even find minutes for some of these guys because Ime Udoka, like many coaches, trust his veterans, likes to run those guys up pretty heavy minutes. And he did that last year with Van Vliet. And that's just going to be part of the deal. So I like the thinking from Houston trying to stretch it out a little bit. The other reason why I think it's smart, and we're starting to see the impact of these new second apron cap rules and all that, you need to have the young guys on rookie contracts as contributors. Look at Boston with Sam Hauser, Peyton Pritchard, giving you some of those playoff minutes from guys who are basically making next to nothing. You have to have those guys around once you sign some of these young players, whether it's Jabari Smith, whether it's Jalen Green. You sign some of those guys to their second contracts and they get a lot more expensive. So I think just from a financial standpoint, it makes more sense to have picks that you can kind of replenish your roster with down the road. So I'll be curious if other people follow this Houston plan. It kind of felt like they were maybe, quote unquote, cutting edge here for the new cap environment. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I also think that if I'm the Rockets and I've got all this Phoenix capital, I sit back and I wait.
Yeah.
I don't do anything crazy this offseason, Ben. Maybe you go out, sign somebody to a short-term deal, do something strategic, but I wait. Because I'm of the opinion that Phoenix is going to implode.
Like, right.
I don't believe that replacing Frank Vogel with Mike Budenholzer is this magic dust, that you sprinkle a little Mike Budenholzer offensive philosophies on this team, and suddenly they turn into a 60-win team that is competing for a championship. They still need a point guard. They still need players now. You've got Eric Gordon just opting out of his contract. He was shooting the three pretty well for him. We saw, not all that we wanted to see from the trio of Durant, Booker, and Bradley Beal. We saw enough, and it wasn't really that good.
It was horrible. I mean, honestly,
I guess I'm being nice.
Yeah, you're being nice.
It was bad. So the point is, I don't believe the Suns are going to blow their team up this year, or at least not this summer. It's not going to happen. But if this team is mired in mediocrity around the trade deadline, and you've got a chance if you're Phoenix to get some of that draft capital back, I wouldn't trade them Devin Booker, not unless Devin Booker was like, I can't take it here anymore, I want out. But if there's an opening to trade Durant for some of that draft capital, I would do it. I would wait, and I would do it. Because right now, I think the Rockets are in a good position. They're an improving team. They're going to be better next year. I happen to love Alperen Sengun. I think Alperen Sengun is going to come back shooting like 38% from three next year. And if that guy's shooting like 38% from three, how do you stop him? Like, he's mini Jokic in that sense. So I think they're going to be better overall. And then I just wait, man. I just wait and watch the implosion that I think is going to happen in Phoenix. Because I have no faith that the Suns can add whatever they think they're going to add and turn themselves into the contender they want to be.
I hear you, man. You're talking implosion. It makes me think of like an earthquake or something. Like, we got the tremor during the playoffs, didn't we? When they got swept by the Minnesota Timberwolves. Like, you got the first taste of what it could look like. Mm-hmm. Bradley Beal kind of being chippy towards the coach. Booker calling out Vogel and everybody for communication issues, which, what are you even talking about, right? Durant trying to take responsibility, unwilling to explain at all what was going on because he didn't want to be seen like he was making excuses. Didn't exactly seem as happy as he did when he first got there, when he first got traded there. I mean, it was kind of a night and day perspective from him. I do think I take their ownership and, their statement at their word that they're not interested in trading Kevin Durant this summer. I hope they're not. And I also think it's important for some of these guys to realize, look, Kevin, you're in your mid-30s, you're getting towards your late-30s. Nobody at that stage of their career was making an impact besides Al Horford, of all players, late in this postseason, right? It just wasn't a thing. All the older guys, that entire generation, LeBron, Steph, KD, the list goes on, kind of got punted one by one as we went through the playoffs and the play-in tournament, the early round of the playoffs. So you can have a successful season. Even if you went there thinking you were going to win a championship, if you go out, win 50 games and lose in the first round, it's really not the end of the world. I do think reality will set in for some of these guys. And I hope it does, because trying to live and die with title or bust expectations when you've got the Anthony Edwards and the Jason Tatums and John Morant coming back, Jokic in his prime, Giannis coming back, like, these guys are basically 10 years younger. They're supposed to be running the league. It's okay to lose in the first round. It doesn't have to be the end of the world.
Every team but Portland is going to take a step forward, right? Mm. Like, Portland celebrated the Denny Abja era. Like, so a lot of backslapping there over trading two first-round picks for Denny Abja. Like,
that was like one of their best moves in 3 years, Chris. So, I mean,
that's a, you know, now they've got three centers out there, none of whom can play together. So that's a big task for Joe Cronin to figure out. But every team in that conference, Ben, but Portland is going to be really good. Like, the Spurs are going to find a way to take a step forward. New Orleans, whether they bring in back this group or making a trade with Brandon Ingram, is going to find a way with Zion to probably take a step forward. Like Memphis, as you mentioned, all their guys coming back, there's no reason to believe they won't be back, you know, fighting for a spot at the top of the Western Conference. I don't see the pathway for Phoenix. And I think if the Rockets can be patient, there's an opportunity there for them to make a big splash at midseason or maybe as late as next season. Last thing I want to hit you on. We've got free agency starting in just a couple of days. A lot of dominoes have already fallen with OG signing some of the trades that have been made. But we still don't know what's going to happen with Paul George. And Lawrence Frank spoke to reporters after the draft this week. Didn't really offer much insight into the future of Paul George. But we seem to have a pretty good idea that Paul George, in his early 30s, wants that four-year max contract. This will be the last big contract of his career, and he wants that four-year deal. It doesn't sound like Philadelphia's all in on him at this point. I don't know what Orlando's game plan is, though I do know they know they got to spend money. Like, this summer's their year to spend some money. Houston, we've talked about kind of lurking out there. What are you looking for in the Paul George free agency? Because he's the one guy, I think, that could really be a needle mover wherever he winds up next.
Well, first thing, you know, I did an interview with Paolo Banchero a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago or so now, and he said, look, I want to be an offensive hub. I don't want to have to play point forward. And I thought that was a really interesting distinction. So to me, that says if you're Orlando, you should be thinking about spending some of that money, or potentially if it's trades, trying to find yourself a real traditional point guard, or at least a game manager type point guard to take some of that burden off Paolo so he could be his best self, because he had a really nice breakout second season. He actually didn't really get a ton of credit for it. But number two, I do think that they really want spacing and shooting down there, right? And Paul George brings that to the table, but he's going to bring it to the table at a monster price. And I think when you're a developing young team like the Magic or any team in that situation, you have to think long and hard about paying somebody their quote-unquote third contract, right? Like, I mean, that's when you start to get into those crazy astronomical numbers that are huge and take up a massive portion of your salary cap and limit your ability to be deep and limit your ability to kind of make other moves. And kind of box you in. If that player gets hurt, you're just stuck, right? I mean, we've seen that with the Clippers time and time again, whether it's Paul George or Kawhi Leonard, sometimes it's both of them, right? So I think the idea of Paul George is better than the reality when you take into account the financial side. He was actually pretty healthy last season. He was productive last season. He's still an all-star level player. If he went to a place like Golden State, he could take them up the tiers in the Western Conference and bump them up to maybe the edge of contention. I'm not sure I would call them like A-list contenders, but he would be a lot better for them than Klay Thompson was. But there's only a few teams who I think that would really be in that kind of spot, viewing him as the piece to kind of get over the hump. The fascinating part to me here, the Clippers are opening this brand new arena, right? They've been hyping this up for 5 years. I've been going to events about the Intuit Dome for 4 to 5 years now, where they've been
I just pitching. Got another email about it. Just another email from Intuit Dome PR or whatever it was. Yeah.
Right. And so they've been pitching their season ticket holders. They designed this whole wall idea, you know, the diehard section. They want this to be a big deal. I'm here to tell you, the fans like Paul George. They like Russell Westbrook. Those are the guys on this team that they actually like. Kawhi Leonard's missed so much time. He's kept the fans at such a distance that they don't really embrace Kawhi Leonard. If you go to Clippers games, you don't see nearly as many Kawhi Leonard jerseys as you would expect. So this would be a massive black eye for the Clippers if they did not retain Paul George at this moment where they want to be kind of the toast of the town. It would really undercut this plan that they've had going for 5 to 6 years now. So it's just a really tricky choice for them because obviously Ballmer's got the money. There's internal politics. Do you want Paul George to make more than Kawhi? That's a tricky situation you kind of have to work out if you're the Clippers. So there's a lot of variables, but let's just say he does go somewhere else, whether it's Philly, Orlando, Golden State. The Clippers are high and dry. It's almost as bad as the Nets losing their best player to the Knicks, right? Because Nets fans right now have nothing to cheer for except waiting for these draft picks 5 years from now, praying that they can capture the flag, you know, Cooper flag next year in the draft. That's all they have to think about.
I like that. Capture the flag. Yeah, that's the Portland, Washington, Brooklyn mantra.
It's going to stick too, because it's pretty good. But if you're the Clippers, it's like, well, LeBron and Bronny are going to be headline news everywhere you go. LeBron's LeBron. You still got Anthony Davis. J.J. Redick's the new coach. Like, even though you just spent $2 to $3 billion on a new arena, you're going to be an afterthought if you lose Paul George. You can't replace him. You're taking a big step back in the standings if you lose him. That is a lot of leverage. And I think that's why Paul George and his representatives are so smart to play hardball here.
Yeah. I mean, again, you made the point. Like, what is the alternative is you sign nobody. You bring back James Harden, and you have James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and Kawhi Leonard. That's barely a play-in team.
Brutal.
And that's only if Kawhi has a MVP level season that's fully healthy. That's a play-in team. Like, I don't get it. I, you know, you've heard the same things I have about Steve Ballmer wants to go into a dome as a contender. Like, he wants to go in and make a splash. The only way to do that is to bring Paul George back. The only way to bring Paul George back is to give him the kind of four-year deal that he's looking for. That's my read on the situation. And I think Paul, sure, to your point, I think Paul's in a hugely advantageous situation. Right,
do you
now.
Think Ballmer blinks? You think he just pays him?
I do. Yeah, I do. I don't know what, like, I think Philly's, you know, warm on a lot of guys. I think they like the idea of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I think they like the idea to a degree of Klay Thompson. So I think Philly's got some other options out there. I'm not sure if Orlando, with this stage of where their guys are, would go all in on Paul George, because I think Paul George would be a good fit there, because what do we see in the first round? Like, a lack of scoring is a problem in Orlando, especially perimeter scoring. So I think it would work, but does it fit the timeline of the Magic trying to become a contender? Look, if I'm Paul George, I want to get the hell out of the Western Conference. Like, I would welcome, you know, offers from, you know, Philadelphia and from Orlando. Yeah. If I'm looking to compete for a championship, I know Boston's there in the East, but you don't have every series wouldn't be a street fight, you know, in the Eastern Conference. So I'd have that perspective, but I don't know. I think eventually that Ballmer blinks, and whatever the max dollar you have to give Paul George is, you give it to him, and then you let the dust, you know, the chips fall where they may later. I don't know if there's any other alternative.
It would be really weird if he didn't blink, if he didn't get this done, because Ballmer is by far the richest owner in the NBA. So if he loses a bidding war for, like, basically his most popular star right at the moment when he's trying to take over LA, quote unquote, this new building, it would just change my perception of who he is as an owner, right? Like, he's worked really hard to get rid of the stink of Donald Sterling, to build the Clippers into kind of a first-class organization off the court, you know, building up all their infrastructure and all that, to then turn around and pivot away from Paul George. It would feel a little bit like they pivoted away from Blake Griffin. Remember all the grief they caught for doing that? Wound up being a really smart move. And I actually think, depending on how Paul George ages, it might be better off with him 2 years from now, without him 2 years from now, than they would be with him 2 years from now, right? Like, there could be some injury or some fading stuff as he ages. So it's something to think about if you're the Clippers. But for right now, they face so much pressure to keep him. I would be stunned if he went elsewhere. And it would really change how everybody perceives the Clippers as contenders, because they wouldn't be anymore. And then as an organization, because they wouldn't be taking care of their guys.
And let's not forget that the Clippers do not have the option of rebuilding here, because their draft capital, a lot of it belongs to Oklahoma City, of all teams. Like, it belongs to friggin' Oklahoma City. Ben Golliver, Washington Post.
Who do they send back to OKC to get their picks back? That's the question. They got anybody OKC?
Nothing.
I know.
They have nothing. Oklahoma City, like, this is a conversation another day, but, like, you know, I don't know how it even gets done, but, like, I want the Durant reunion in Oklahoma City. Like, he would just work there. Like, he would work. They don't have enough salaries to make it work, I don't think, right now. But, man, that would just work. Like, I mean, I think Kevin would be happy to go back there, too, to be back in that kind of cocoon. And he also wouldn't have to be the man, not with Chet and Shea and all those guys that are there. I just think it's that. Maybe it's a conversation for midseason when they're struggling in that way.
Yeah, it feels too good to be true for this cursed Kevin Durant story lately. You know what I mean?
I know. Ben Golliver, Washington Post. Man, I know you're busy. Thanks for staying up late with me.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Take care.
And when we come back, my conversation with Kevin Sweeney. All right, Kevin Sweeney, the first two-day NBA draft is in the books. And even though this was kind of billed as one of the weaker drafts in recent memory, it certainly had some excitement from the very beginning, where we didn't know who was going to go inside that top five, to the very end, where we saw Bronny James officially drafted at number 55. He will become part of the first father-son tandem in the NBA, which I think, regardless of what you think about Bronny being drafted, that's pretty damn cool that LeBron and Bronny are going to wind up playing together. So let's just start here. Give me your biggest takeaway from this year's draft.
Yeah, look, I thought the weakness of the draft created a lot of uncertainty in the top 10 picks, and that trickled all the way down throughout the first round. I think probably the big surprise was Ron Holland at 5. He was the guy that a lot of people projected could fall. I think there were teams that thought maybe even as far as like the late teens or even 20th, they might be able to get Ron Holland. Instead, Detroit gets aggressive and takes him at 5, adds a kind of high variance piece to their rebuild, right? Another guy who struggles to shoot the basketball, how that fits with Jaden Ivey and Asar Thompson and Kate Cunningham, that's a great question. But it's a big swing by the new leadership group in Detroit. And that led to a draft day slide for Dalton Connect, a draft day slide for Modest Bouzelis from G League Ignite. Really created a lot of chaos in the late half of the lottery and then into the teens and 20s. And I thought, again, you know, because there were such divergent opinions throughout the NBA about so many of these guys, it wasn't a shock that we had something like this happen. But it created a more unpredictable draft night than I think we usually get for both, you know, media members and also NBA teams.
Okay, so let's start with Ron Holland, because that was the most interesting top of the draft selection. Number 5 to Detroit. This is a guy that for the Ignite last year shot about 24% from three-point range. We are in an era, Kevin, where everybody's got to shoot, from point guards to centers, and now Detroit goes out and adds a non-shooter with the 5th overall pick. Trajan Langdon, his first draft with the Pistons, takes what looks like a pretty bold risk. Like, what are they seeing in Ron Holland that maybe other teams might not be?
I think first off, you're seeing elite physical tools. I mean, he is 6'7", 6'8", wiry, athletic, can get downhill, like tremendous in transition. And a guy that, look, I mean, G League Ignite was a disaster. He was put in a bad situation. He also averaged nearly 20 points a game in the G League, right? Like, there's a floor there. If you can average 20 points a game in the G League, no matter how bad your team is, no matter how much, you know, the outside noise is going, like, you're probably going to be okay in the NBA, right? Like, I think that's a safe thing to say. He's going to be able to score the basketball. The question is, as you said, the shooting. And it's, I think, less that he shot 24% and more that when he missed badly, right? Like, with shooters, I think
these were bad misses.
When you scout, right? Like, you can see, all right, this guy has good mechanics and good form and the shot looks good and it's just not going in yet. And like, it will go in eventually. I think there are some questions of whether it will go in eventually, because there were air balls, there were, you know, sides to the backboard, there were like flat, long misses, like ugly, ugly shots. Now, again,
so you're saying he's the Philip Seymour Hoffman in Along Came Polly of basketball players, like the make it rain.
Yeah, it was not good at times. And look, I think most guys would have struggled in a situation like Ignite, where they're surrounded with other young players playing against pros. He was asked to be an alpha offensively, really for the first time in his career. Like, he was always this like phenomenal complimentary piece, amazing, you know, again, transition, opportunistic. And all of a sudden now he's the leading scorer on a team playing against pros at 18. That's a tough context. But I think at the same time, there were reasons for the rest of the league kind of getting down on him over the last month or two and really throughout the G League season. And so I do think it was a pretty big surprise for him to move up to 5.
Yeah, and there were guys on the board that might have made a little more sense for the Pistons. I thought Donovan Clingan, falling as far as he did down to number 7 was pretty interesting. I know Portland had been sitting on him for a while. They were even talking internally about moving up to get Donovan Clingan, and now they get him with the 7th overall pick. That's a guy, Kevin, that, you know, look at the teams drafting 4, 5, and 6. I wonder in a few years if they're regretting that decision, because I think that kid can play.
I mean, that was kind of the great poker game, right? Everyone sort of liked Donovan Clingan. Team below 7 wanted to move up potentially past Portland to get him if they thought that 4, 5, and 6 weren't going to go take him. Portland, did they have to make a move to get him? They eventually didn't. And that was a huge win, I think, for that organization. I thought between that and the Denny Avdia move, like, really, really improved their defense. I mean, Clingan has a chance to be, I don't think it's fair to put Rudy Gobert level defensive expectations on him, but I think he has that potential if things break right. Like, his impact at UConn on the defensive end was ridiculous. And for a Portland team that has, you know, has these young guards that they're trying to build around, addressing the defense was a big concern. And I think those guards give Klingon the best chance of success offensively because he can be a lob threat. He can be someone that can play in the triple handoff game. Like, this was a great situation for him to land in, whether it was a couple spots later than he had hoped.
Yeah, now they just have to figure out what to do with DeAndre Ayton and Rob Williams, because I don't think those three guys are going to be able to play together. I don't think that's a two-headed center rotation that you're going to have up in Portland. Zach Edey at number 9. Like, I had a tweet saved in my drafts, ready to go, for when Zach Edey was drafted, like, between 20 and 30. Basically saying, like, X number of teams are going to regret passing on Zach Edey because this guy, all he did in college was produce. Why are people looking at combine results? Why are they trying to overthink physical tools? Zach Edey's going to be a player. And then, holy shit, 9 to the Grizzlies. Like, that was a big surprise to me. And I'm a big Zach Edey fan, of course. But, I mean, did the Grizzlies reach here? Like, is Zach Edey worth the number 9 overall pick?
I think it was probably a little aggressive, but not far off, right? I don't think you could have realistically moved down too much and gotten him, say, at, you know, 14, 15, 16. We saw all the centers basically in this draft go a little higher than expected. Edey went 9. Khalil Ware went 15. He was kind of expected in the 20s. Deron Holmes was like a fringe first rounder. He goes 22 to Denver, who had to move up to get him. So, look, I think these guys were in demand. Edey's... Look, I saw Zach Kleiman say this in his press conference afterwards. Like Zach Edey gives you an opportunity to dictate the terms of the game, right? Mm. Teams are so focused right now in the NBA on, okay, how do we address this particular matchup? How do we, like, when we're scheming against this team in the West, how are we going to win? And with Edey, you have a guy that can give you a look. And his development curve has been ridiculous. He's still only played organized basketball for like 7 years. He's gotten so much better. It was honestly hilarious to me looking back, and they're showing the clips from him as a freshman and sophomore at Purdue draft night. And I didn't remember how kind of skinny and uncoordinated he looked at that time. Now he's filled out. He moves so well. He's so durable. He's one of the rare 7'4" guys that doesn't look completely like misproportioned. Like, he looks like you just scaled up a 6'11" guy 5 more inches. Like, he is, I think, in many ways built to last in the NBA. And look, there will be questions defensively. I think he will be able to hang in on that end of the floor. He's more mobile than people give him credit. He is able to protect the rim more when he's not asked to stay on the floor for 30, 40 minutes a game like he was in college. And he's going to be able to punish mismatches, right? Like, he will put dudes under the rim, even in the NBA. Like, his physicality is kind of unmatched, and he has great hands to go with it. So he's going to really catch passes from Ja, post up and score, and also be a lob threat because of his size. I mean, he's, you know, basically 3 inches under the rim once he reaches up. So I liked it. I know I think it's aggressive. It's, look, I think one of the main reasons you didn't draft Zach Edey was you were worried that if it didn't work, you were going to look like an idiot, right? Mm-hmm. And if Memphis isn't worried about that, then I think it's well worth the risk.
Yeah, I think if there was any team that was going to reach, Memphis was probably the best one to do it for all the reasons you kind of laid out there. I mean, it was painfully obvious last year that, and the year before too, that Jaren Jackson Jr. is not a 5, right? Like, they missed Steven Adams over the last couple of seasons, that big physical presence. And Zach Edey, in a way, is a cheaper and right now a lesser version of Steven Adams. They can develop him into anything close to what Adams gave them on both ends of the floor. That's a huge win. Like, you mentioned kind of being a lob threat around the rim, punishing mismatches. He's also a great screener. So, like, John Morant's going to have a big body to run around as he's kind of chasing the floor. I think Jaren Jackson Jr.'s athleticism is going to, you know, make up for some of the weaknesses in Zach Edey's game. I think that if there's one concern, it's like there's really not great range on Edey at the moment. Like, if he's hanging around the rim, does that clog up the paint for guys like Morant? But that, like, the positives, I think, far outweigh the negatives for Zach Edey. So I like that pick a lot for them. And look, he's got room to grow, but you can throw him into a game, you know, right away and expect him to produce on some level. He's not some 18-year-old that's going to need time to develop physically. He's ready to go physically in the NBA. So I did like that pick for them. A lot of people were surprised to see Dalton Knecht slip as far as he did. I mean, you saw the video in that Lakers war room. It was like they were popping champagne corks in there to get, you know, this kid who is a terrific shooter in college. A lot of people had pegged going a little bit higher, the Lakers, as every team is wont to do, said, you know, we had him rated way higher. We thought he was a top 10 overall pick. Why do you think Knecht slipped as far as he did? And what kind of, you know, fit do you see with him and the Lakers?
Look, I think for the Lakers, it's a huge win because you get one of the rare prospects that kind of fits their dual timelines. He's old enough and proven enough a shot maker that he can come in and help the Lakers next year, right? He can give them an extra piece in their rotation as they try to, you know, push for one more, you know, championship with LeBron. But at the same time, it gives you a potential longer term piece. He's young, he's controllable. He's a top 10 talent in the draft. I know that, again, that's the common refrain, but I mean, he was phenomenal at Tennessee. I mean, beat every expectation possible. One of the best one-year transfers really in college basketball history. A dominant three-level scorer, explosive off the floor as an athlete, elite shot maker, shooter. Like, defensively, there are concerns. I think that held him back on draft night. His age, you know, is he a finished product at 23? I think that held him back. I also think, you know, it was one of those things. He was a victim of some of that chaos at the top because, you know, his agent really kept things tight. You know, it was a small range of teams he worked out with in the back half of the top 10. When all of a sudden Holland goes and that's a wrench, and Klingon falls to 7, that's a wrench. That was a spot that people expected him to be. The Spurs trading out of 8, that was a spot where people thought the Knecht could go. All of a sudden, now you're dealing with teams that didn't work him out, weren't as comfortable with him, and some other names that were also top 10 prospects like Bouzelis at 11 and Carter at 13. It just made life difficult for Knecht, so he falls to 17. But I love the fit. I think he'll be really, really good. I think the age factor is overrated because he's someone who has consistently gotten better. I mean, look, this guy averaged 9 points a game in 2022-23 at Northern Colorado and is now a top 10 draft pick. Like, there's a development curve here. Maybe he's a late bloomer. You know, maybe it's just, you know, his finally getting the opportunity, but he is really, really good, and you don't do what he did in college basketball. Like the season he had is as impressive a year for a kind of big wing scorer as I've seen in a long time.
I think the question I have, and I talked to a few people that were drafting in that range, is just how bad is he defensively? Like, how unplayable is he on that end of the floor? And look, it struck me, Kevin, that Miami and Philly passed on him. And those are two teams that are not afraid to draft older players. Miami just did that last year with Jaime Jaquez. Worked out pretty damn well for them. And Philly needs kind of wing scoring. That's kind of a hole for them, especially with Tobias Harris probably exiting this offseason. Both those teams passed on him in favor of different players. And look, from Miami's perspective, some of the things I heard was like, you know, if we're going to play Tyler Hero, we can't play Tyler Hero and Dalton Knecht out there because that's two non-defenders we'd have out there on the floor. So I guess that's sort of my question. Like, yeah, I think offensively they'll find great ways to use him in that Lakers system. I mean, the Lakers are kind of like a bad TV show right now. Like, you know, Rob Pelinka comes out and is like, oh, JJ Redick was drawing up pin downs. Like, wow, pin downs. What are those? Today's NBA. It's crazy. Like, how it's sort of become this reality show in Los Angeles. But like they had some defensive issues last year. Like, D'Angelo Russell was a minus defender for them. Anthony Davis is great, but around that team, there are, you know, a bunch of guys that don't defend on the highest level. Like, they can't play him if he's, even if he's out there knocking down threes, if he's getting burned on the other end, that's this year, next year, it's just going to be tough to play. So I guess that's my question. Like, is he average defensively? Because you can get away with average defensively, but if you're bad defensively, then you're in a lot of trouble in the NBA.
So it's funny because this time last year, we were having the exact same conversation about him in college. Like, Dalton Knecht chose Tennessee over a bunch of other destinations, and everyone was like, is Rick Barnes, who's like defense extraordinaire, like cares way too much about that end of the floor, has always been the rap, is he even going to let Dalton Knecht play because he's so bad defensively? And, you know, it turned out, one, he was good enough that it didn't matter, and two, like, he was better defensively at Tennessee than he was at Northern Colorado. Tools wise, he should be a fine defender. He's 6'6", chiseled body, actually tested really well at the combine in terms of like his mobility and agility. Like, he, like his, you know, kind of like the lane drills and things like that. Like he was one of the faster guys. So it's not like he's too slow footed to guard people. It's not like he's not athletic enough. Like he has all the tools to be okay defensively. I think it's more of an awareness and an effort thing for him. And, you know, at the next level, like if he doesn't want to work on defense, he's not going to play. Right. So I think that will be motivation enough. Will he ever be a plus defender? I doubt it. Can he be serviceable enough to make his offensive game a value add? I think so.
Let me ask you about the guy drafted last in the first round, Bailey Sherman, who, like, going into this draft, I was pretty convinced the Celtics were going to move out of that last spot, only for financial reasons, right? Like, they've got a 7-man rotation that is almost uncrackable. And if you draft somebody at the back end of the first round, you know, to summarize it, that salary at $3 million probably cost them $9 million because of the cap penalties that come along with it. But they wind up drafting, you know, speaking of older players, a 5-year college player who is 23 years old, shoots the lights out of the ball. I don't know. Because I'm based in Boston, do a lot of TV in Boston, I started watching a lot of his clips. Like, there's maybe a little connection, for lack of a better phrase there. Bailey Sherman, do you think he's someone that can contribute right away to an NBA team?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Bailey Sherman was the best player at the combine who played in the scrimmages, at least. Like, he was dominant. You know, every so often, like, you just see a guy that's like, yeah, he's too good for these, you know, fringe first round scrimmages. Bailey Sherman was too good. You know, he's 6'6". He's a really, really elite 3-point shooter. I mean, he made 110 threes last year at Creighton and did so off movement, you know, with every type of defensive coverage against him. Like, he found ways to hunt shots. He's also like a really, really high feel guy who can be a connector offensively. Like, he's not someone who can only run off screens and that's it, right? He can handle the ball a little bit. He makes quick decisions. He's been really, really well coached in his college career, and I think that will help him. Will there be some limitations defensively in terms of his, you know, foot speed? Yes, but he's not a bad defender. He's probably a better defender than Kinect is right now. So I really like this pick, right? I think teams have had to reshape how they want to draft in the back half of the first round. You know, these contender type teams, because of the second apron and the limited options you have now to go out and improve your roster otherwise. And so, look, I think Denver's been kind of the most obvious of, like, we're just going to draft as many like old college players we can get and see if we can find guys who can be in our rotation for cheap. And I think if you're the Celtics, like, yes, you're going to pay a tax penalty to do it, but given the other options to improve your roster, like, this is your best chance. And I thought getting Bailey Sherman was a win in that regard. He's a guy who I think can help. Look, I mean, what they've done with Sam Hauser is unbelievable. Yeah. I don't think anyone really thought Sam Hauser was an NBA player. Bailey Sherman's a way better prospect, a way better mover, and a similar level shooter. And I think if you're getting that type of piece, it's well worth the financial risk at 30.
Yeah, and the Celtics are in a bit of a different position than the Lakers in that, just like with Sam Hauser, they surrounded Sam Hauser with four great defenders. Like, he was always on the floor with elite defensive players. I don't know if Shireman's going to play next year necessarily, but, you know, Sam Hauser, if there's not a contract extension for him, he could be somewhere else in a year, 2 years. And that point, having somebody on a cheap contract to step in is going to benefit a Celtics team that is going to have a roster that is wildly expensive in the next couple of years with a new contract for Jason Tatum, a contract extension for Derek White. I liked it. I think that's a potential high upside pick for them as they're trying to build out a winner over the next couple of years. All right. Second round, day two of this draft. And the top of the second round was dominated by one of the more bizarre stories I've heard in recent draft memory. And that's Kyle Filipowski from Duke. Very good player. 7-footer with a skill set. Like, guys like that, we just talked about centers. Guys like that don't stay on the board this long unless there are concerns. And then, like, in the aftermath of day one, I think it was Jonathan Givony that kind of first put this into the universe, that there were issues teams had with Kyle Filipowski's girlfriend, right? Who is apparently older than him, not the most popular person within the family. You saw Kyle's brother out there on social media making some comments. Like, it was wild, Kevin. It was really wild to see the curtain get pulled back on this story in real time. He winds up going to Utah, which is, you know, the perfect landing spot given the background of this story. And now we wonder, you know, just how much all this stuff means. Like, is it just kind of white noise that's a personal issue that guys can deal with and play through? Or, you know, were the concerns that teams had about drafting him in the first round, were they legitimate? How do you read it?
Yeah, this story with his girlfriend has been something that kind of circles around industry rumor mills and whatnot for a couple of months now. Like, this has been known since the college season that, you know, Kyle's girlfriend is a lot older than him, that she has kind of driven a wedge between him and his family, potentially driven a wedge between him and the rest of the Duke roster, that there were problems there. Did it really impact his production at Duke? No, he was really good. Like, it didn't, like, Duke, if Duke had any chemistry issues, they weren't really seen. Like, they were a good team. They were a consistently good team throughout the college season. I don't think it was so out of the realm of possibility that he would slip out of the first round that we should make this. It's like, Kyle Filipowski's girlfriend cost him X millions of dollars, right? Like, this is like, yeah, I think things have gone too far. He was always kind of a late teens to 20s guy. And, you know, all it takes is a couple of kind of things that don't go your way to drop, right? Johnny Furphy from Kansas was pretty much a similar draft range, right? It's not his girlfriend's fault that he fell to 35. So I do think it got maybe a little overplayed just because it went so viral. And I mean, I thought it was really unfortunate that his family was weighing in on social media. Look, like, I don't blame them. Obviously, it seems like a really difficult situation, but just like for Kyle's sake, like the fact that his draft day was spent dealing with this and seeing this, like, this should have been like the celebration of his life. And the fact that like people in his own family were tweeting about like why they don't like his girlfriend.
They were trying to tell his story, Kevin. Like, I saw his brother basically saying, I DM'd Gavoni to give him the details of it.
That was insane.
What the hell?
It was, I've never seen anything like it. Look, I don't personally expect that this will be something that stops Kyle Filipowski from being a useful NBA player, but I do think it was something that was in the back of mind of teams. I think, again, some of the ways he answered questions about that with teams and interviews was something that I think will be in the back of mind.
It wasn't good. Like, I checked in with teams in the 20s about this story, and a couple of them told me that when they, because they knew about it too, like, you know, teams do their research. When they started to probe him about it a little, he got really uncomfortable talking about it. And that raised, you know, look, as you said, like, it's kind of the difference when you're being drafted that late, potentially in the first round, one little thing can cause a team to look in a different direction. I think that did cause a couple of teams to look in different directions because they just weren't truly comfortable with kind of how he answered these questions in interviews.
He also had double hip surgery last year, right? Like, this is not like he was a...
That might be a problem, too.
He wasn't like a completely flawless prospect. Like, I do think he moves better than people give him credit for. I think he's really skilled. I think he'll find a way to be productive. But this was not such a can't-miss situation that all of a sudden some of the other factors don't start to play in. And I think they did and kind of partially catalyzed his drop.
You know, I do think that from a talent perspective, I thought Utah got great value in back half of the first, early second. I mean, I watched a lot of Isaiah Collier on the Bronny beat last year, and there was a time that he was considered top five prospect at some point. And that USC team was just they were a mess. Like, they had a lot of problems that had nothing to do, I think, with the talent of Isaiah Collier. Then, you know, Bronny comes back, and you're trying to weave him in while doing your own thing. He's got the physical tools to be a point guard in this league. And the Jazz, Keontae George turned out to be a good player for them last year. Now you add Collier to that mix, and you've got two good young point guards that you can build around. I really like that pick. And look, Filipowski, we'll see. Like, I think his talent, you know, late lottery type talent, it looks like. And again, 7-footers with you know, playmaking ability, shooting abilities, like, they're incredibly valuable in today's NBA. I like what they did in Utah. I think it doesn't guarantee it's going to work out, but I think they went for high value guys in the back half of this draft.
Yeah. And look, their three draft picks, Cody Williams from Colorado at 10, Collier at 29, and Filipowski at 32. Those three guys were all top 10 recruits out of high school. Williams is like the big slashing wing, and obviously has the pedigree with his brother Jalen's emergence. I think teams valued the idea that, like, all right, if his brother was a late bloomer, maybe he is too. Collier was a guy that, you know, very, you know, before the season may well have been the number one pick. Like, this guy is very, very dynamic in ball screens. He's a big time talent, right? I know not every kind of failed college freshman turns into Tyrese Maxey, right? But like, that's the vision if you're Utah, right? It's like, here's a guy that was a super touted recruit, didn't have a great year, a lot of things beyond his control. Let's not forget all the past tape. So I thought at 29, that was a great value pick, right? I think it's fascinating when guys drop, right? Like, at 10, would Collier have been a reach? Yeah, I think based on the year at USC, I think 10 would have been early. But at 29, like, why not, right? Again, compared to the other pieces on the board, like, you're getting a really, really high level of talent. And so I love what Utah did. I thought they were one of the winners of draft days, I guess, would be the operative word now.
All right, so let's talk about Bronny, who goes number 55 to the Lakers, which was always the most likely outcome here. The Lakers were not drafting him with their first-round pick. Bronny elected not to work out for any teams but the Lakers and Suns. And over the last couple of days, it just seemed, unless something shocking happened, he was going to go number 55 to the Lakers. I said earlier in the show that I am not outraged by the Lakers drafting Bronny, because if you're going to scream nepotism and wasted draft pick, I need you to go back on Basketball Reference and look at the number 55 picks over the last 10 years and tell me which one of them has worked out. I think you had to go back like 7 years to find a guy that played more than three seasons, sparingly in more than three seasons in the NBA. It is not a pick where you get a lot of value, that's for sure. And look, you know, I know Bronny's numbers, you know, 5 points per game, poor shooting at USC, but he did have a heart attack last summer, and he did have to slowly work his way back from that cardiac incident. And when I watch him, Kevin, like, I don't know if he's an NBA player. Like, I know I hear the Davion Mitchell, you know, comparisons, but you know, there are very few Davion Mitchells, right? Like, guys that are small, great defensive players, like, they're not... they're very rare in coming out of the draft. But he does have good length. He does have good defensive instincts. He does have great athleticism. Put it this way. I think there have been lower upside picks at 55 than Bronny James. So, yeah, you're doing that in part to placate LeBron. You want him to be happy. You want him to come back happy. And if you passed on him, that probably would have been a shitty conversation to have with him at some point. But I do think that drafting Bronny gives you a young player who's only, what, 18, 19 years old, who, you know, you don't know. Like, I don't think you can look at the stats from last year and say that's who Bronny James is. I honestly think if you gave him a full year back in college and he came out in next year's draft, he'd probably go a lot higher. He might even go somewhere in the back half of the first round. So I think the Lakers, in what is a relatively meaningless pick, got themselves a player that could turn out to be a part of their team.
Yeah, look, I thought it was funny. You know, there's all this outrage about how, like, this is a wasted draft pick and, like, how could they do that? Yada, yada, yada. And then, like, as they're discussing this, they announced the last pick in the draft by the Knicks, who is Ariel Hakporti from Germany, who played in Australia last year. And Gavoni comes on the screen. And I think his final words of the draft were, yeah, this guy will be overseas for a while, but could be a third string NBA center one day. And you're like, all right, like people light second round picks on fire all the time. Why are we so offended by this use of lighting a second round pick on fire? If that's how you feel, right? Like, look, I think as I see things similar to you. I think Bronny is not a hopeless case. I think there's a chance he winds up being a valuable NBA player. It is a narrow path, obviously, but given the context of USC, I don't think it's fair to say like he's completely, you know, done, right? And AJ Johnson went 23rd to the Bucks. He averaged 2.3 points per game in Australia last year. Why is that such a great pick? And Bronny at 55 is incomprehensible. At the end of the day, the Lakers got who they wanted, right? They got connected 17. That was a huge win. Three guys came off the board after Bronny, and then they got to pick whoever they wanted in the undrafted market. Realistically, had they not drafted Bronny and they picked someone else at 55, it would have been one of the guys they probably tried to sign on a two-way in the minutes after the draft. This is not some huge disaster for the Lakers organization. This is not some massive problem, right? I share everyone else's question marks with Bronny, whether he will actually pan out as an NBA player, but I don't quite understand why people feel so strongly that it's a disastrous pick. Like, I understand that people will say one more person could have heard their name called and had a dream realized, whatever. But like, look, life's not fair. There's plenty of guys who get their name called in the draft who have no business getting drafted that are stash picks. Like, we're not like that far removed from when people would sell second round picks for like $1 million because they just didn't want to. Or like, why do we care so much? The NBA took two picks away for tampering, right? If we cared that much about everybody getting their name called, we wouldn't take picks away from teams. So I don't feel so strongly about it. I think he's 55 was the right place for him to go.
I mean, I heard their name called by Mark Tatum in a hostage video in a bunker at the ESPN studios. I mean, like I'm with you there. That doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot to me. I do think, though, as we look at Bronny, I'm not convinced the Lakers are the best place for him to go. I mean, the scrutiny that's going to be on him is going to be so much bigger because he is, at least nominally, going to be sharing a locker room with his father. Now, we both know Bronny is most likely going to spend most of the year with the South Bay Lakers, you know, playing in the G League and trying to develop there. But he'll spend some time, you know, with the Lakers, on the Lakers, in the Lakers locker room, on their bench. And it's going to be kind of a circus. It is. It's great for him to get to play with his dad. I mean, again, I go back to what we said at the top. That's friggin' cool, man. Like, father-son duo, especially with LeBron still playing at the level that he's at. But for me, like, I wonder if it was a mistake to only work out for the two teams. Like, might a team like, I'm just making it up, like Orlando or Milwaukee or somebody else, if they had worked out Bronny, had more of a chance to talk to him, engaged more with him, would they have been interested in using a second round pick to draft him? Like, Rich Paul obviously believes that whether it's Phoenix or LA, that was the best path for him. That was going to help him maximize his potential. And I respect that. I disagree a little bit. I think the spotlight is going to be so bright next year on Bronny playing alongside his dad that for his own development, for his own future, maybe getting away from that would be the best. Maybe like going to the San Antonio Spurs and, you know, playing for the Austin, what is it, the Toros now? They're the Austin Spurs, whatever they are. Playing for their G League affiliate. Maybe that would have been best for him. So that's my only question when it comes to Bronny. I think he's a perfectly valid number 55 pick. I don't know if the Lakers are the best place for him.
Yeah, look, I think the fishbowl is going to be real. It's going to be hard for him to deal with. I think the thing that was challenging for Rich Paul in this process probably was at the end of the day, they needed to know that there was like a floor at 55 for Bronny, right? Like, how much could they push him elsewhere? I don't know. But I think they needed to know that like the Lakers would take him at, if nothing else, and like save face and like this whole operation moves forward. He gets drafted. He completes really a remarkable year long turnaround from, you know, the cardiac arrest to being an NBA draft pick. I mean, that's pretty cool on its face. And so, I think, you know, the feeling was like, let's shut him down. Let's control the narrative. Let's not have it feel like he's sliding in the draft because X team had interest, whatever. Like, let's pigeonhole him to this destination and make sure he lands where we want him to land. I do think it will be hard for him in LA, but I'm also not sure that anyone else would have had that much interest, right? I think a lot of teams would have had some interest in him on a two-way. The problem is, Rich Paul has been very open. Like, Bronny was not taking it two-way, right? I think there was the Australia comment, which has been quite blown up. It's also not new, right?
Yeah,
agents manipulate second round picks all the time to try to make sure that they get kind of desired terms and desired destinations. So, look, I think the concern to getting him guaranteed money kind of required him going to LA. And so because of that, you deal with the fishbowl and you deal with the high expectations.
And now we begin the Bryce James watch to see if he winds up on, what is he? Is he a senior this year?
He is a rising high school senior, 2025 high school recruit. And, I've seen him play a few times and, I think it will be harder to spin than the Bronny thing. Let's put it there.
Really? Okay. I haven't watched him at all. So just Instagram clips is what I see of Bryce James.
He looks taller, which makes people interested because everyone views the main issue with Bronny being the height. But he has more work to do than Bronny did at this point to make himself a viable prospect in any form. I think right now, like if he was, you know, Bryce Smith instead of Bryce James, like mm-hmm. he'd be very much talked about as like a run-of-the-mill mid-major prospect.
I like this new trend, though, of superstars getting family members on the bench. You got Giannis and Thanasis. You got LeBron and his kid and Bronny. And, like, who's next? Like, does, like, Steph Curry have a cousin that he needs to get drafted? Like, can, you know, someday Victor Wembanyama is going to have somebody over and playing in Paris that he wants on the Spurs? I love this trend. It's great. It's
Damian Lillard had, like, some guy who played at Montana State and averaged, like, 10 points a game. Keep getting like summer league invites with the Trailblazers every year, and I always thought that was kind of funny. So yeah, it's the nepotism thing rules. It's not just it's not exclusive to LeBron.
Gotta love it. Kevin Sweeney, great work all week over on the draft on SI.com. Make sure you check out all of Kevin's stuff from the draft over on SI.com. Good to catch up with you, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, sir.
Are you struggling with weight loss? Scared of getting the shot? Golo is a better way to lose weight. No prescriptions or insurance required. Just take one Relief supplement with each meal and follow the Golo for Life plan. Golo's Relief contains 7 natural plants and 3 key minerals to target body fat and combat the stress of dieting. Golo is clinically proven to work and safely and effectively controls sugar cravings and hunger while minimizing muscle loss, so you feel good and inspired to reach your goal weight. Stop going with the latest fad starvation diet. Stop depleting yourself and robbing your body of energy. Start living your best life today. Golo is effective and affordable, so before you consider drastic measures like the fad diets and new weight loss injections with potentially dangerous side effects, including significant muscle loss, learn more about Golo at Golo.com. Again, that's Golo.com. Join the 5 million who have already made the switch to Golo today. Visit Golo.com. That's Golo.com.